funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
In late fall 1999, the country became obsessed with the story of a 5-year-old Cuban boy rescued miles off the coast of Fort Lauderdale.
Elian Gonzalez was rescued by Florida fishermen on Thanksgiving Day after his mother and stepfather drowned trying to reach the U.S.
The detail that has stuck with me more than the international custody battle that followed is how Elian Gonzalez explained his survival when his mother and 11 others on their doomed refugee raft drowned. The boy told rescuers that as he floated, he was surrounded by dolphins who stayed with him after every human in his party had disappeared and kept him from slipping off the little life ring that saved his life. You're listening to Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd. Ancient works of art prove that humans have been fascinated by the athleticism and intelligence of dolphins for millennia. But even as we marvel at their beauty and document their intellectual ability, we've also done them a great deal of harm. Dolphins have been hunted, held captive, and made to perform for our amusement, and damaged by the growing presence of man-made sonar that interferes with their ability to communicate. Journalist Susan Casey explores these paradoxes in her new book, Voices in the Ocean, A Journey into the Wild and Haunting World of Dolphins. Susan, welcome back to Think.
Thank you.
You had this amazing close-up encounter with dolphins in the wild, and your lasting impression was that they were otherworldly.
That was my first encounter with dolphins. It wasn't, of course, my first time in the ocean with large animals. Mm. I've written about great white sharks. I've spent plenty of time in the water and encountered all kinds of ocean creatures. But until that particular encounter, I had never had any sort of up close and personal meeting with dolphins. And when I had the opportunity to sort of spend, I think it was maybe 15 minutes with them, I was astonished by how present they were and how when you looked at them, you were very conscious of the fact that there was somebody looking back. And there was a type of communication going on that was interesting, although, of course, you know, I can't really explain exactly what it was. And so the book was my odyssey into their world to try to understand what that moment was about and why, when I got out of the water, I felt so changed by it.
You write in the book about a community of people who literally believe dolphins are this mystical source of goodness in the world, but you're also careful to challenge the notion that they are these like friendly guardian angels of the ocean. They're frankly more complex than that.
Exactly. They're fascinating, beings in their own right. They don't also need to be angels or extraterrestrials. They, as a biological creature, they have so much going on that, you know, it's hard to imagine adding any bells and whistles.
So they have these gigantic, highly capable brains. Those are expensive from an evolutionary perspective. They take a lot of energy. What do dolphins need those brains for?
Well, that's a fabulous question. And my inquiries into the dolphin brain were some of the most fascinating reporting trips that I did. So backing up a little bit, dolphins have had their big brains for about 55 million years, as opposed to our own evolution. We developed our big brains somewhere between 800,000 and 200,000 years ago. So first of all, they've had this heavy artillery for much, much longer than we have. So it has evolved very specifically for them in their realm, which is, of course, the ocean. And so when scientists got the equipment to really look at dolphin brains in detail, the MRI scanners, the CT scanners, they were able to see this is a completely different wiring than our brain. And yet we've arrived at the same destination, high intelligence in our environment. Dolphin brains have structures that if you were designing a high-speed computer, you would basically take their design over ours. Hmm. They have a much bigger area where they process emotions, a very highly developed limbic system that is so elaborated that it's actually sort of blurped out an extra lobe. And scientists don't know exactly what's going on with that, but they surmise that it means that these animals are doing something very sophisticated when they're processing their emotions. They have also a very unique type of neuron in their brain called a spindle cell, And we have them as well. Dolphins have about three times, scientists think, more of these cells than we do and evolved them far earlier than we did. And they are rare in among animals. They indicate high-level processing in areas like socializing with one another, empathy. Really important areas of the brain have these cells in them. When we lose our spindle cells, say we have some sort of neurological damage, what happens is we can't get along in society. So it's the theory about why dolphins have such big brains and what they're doing with these brains is that it's all about having a very complicated social life, being a very social animal. And there are even some indications that the socializing and part of a dolphin's life is even more intricate and important than it is for humans. So, and that's a long answer, but I could talk about the dolphin brain for the next 30 years.
Well, they even, there's a mechanism in their brain that if they develop something that would look like type 2 diabetes in a human, there's a, like a chemical switch that goes off.
Yeah, I'm not sure if that's located in the brain. I do know that there's a lot of questions about what are they able to do within themselves? I mean, again, they've evolved so long and so beautifully for their niche. The diabetes on-off switch is one genetic sort of interesting finding that scientists have recently been looking at. There's another one that's equally fascinating, and that's that dolphins have these extraordinary wound healing capabilities and seem to be able to deal with pain in a completely different way than we do. So if you were to, let's say a shark took a big chunk out of the side of a dolphin, maybe even as big as a football, the dolphin would heal with no hemorrhaging, no infection, no deformity, no scarring, and the appearance of not really being that bothered by the wound. And that is pretty extraordinary when you consider that the ocean is just filled with viruses and bacteria. So obviously, this is a brand new area that scientists are looking at. It hasn't been studied extensively. But I read a letter. This is my favorite science publication name ever, in the Journal of Investigative Dermatology, where a scientist had basically said, hey, we have to look at this more carefully because their tissues may well contain a kind of natural morphine, and that's something that we really should investigate. And it's also possible, although at this point it's a hypothesis, that somehow within their own bodies, the dolphins are generating the stem cells to rebuild the tissue that was damaged. So, like, it's not repair, it's actually complete regeneration. And that there's even the possibility that they may be extracting antibiotics and antimicrobial compounds from plants in the ocean and somehow storing them in their own bodies for when they need to heal a wound. I mean, that's pretty mind-blowing if that's something that they're actually doing. So
I was thinking about this, that, you know, so they've had these gigantic brains for 55 million years. They seem to be, you know, not engaging in like group conflict. Like they'll band together to protect themselves from prey, but they're not fighting each other necessarily on a regular basis. Maybe like the fact that they live in the ocean and not on land means that they don't have to use their big brains to concern themselves with a bunch of stuff in the same way that humans do.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's always a really interesting thought experiment to try to imagine the life of a creature that's dealing in a different element and with a different sensory capacity than we have. I mean, there's a famous essay called What Is It Like to Be a Bat? And, you know, I thought a lot about what is it like to be a dolphin. And a scientist named Harry Gerritsen, a paleoneurologist, he wrote basically an equivalent essay to the bat one. And his findings were super interesting. He believes that the dolphin's sense of self actually might be different than our own. So obviously, if you put a different brain into your head, you have a different view of reality. And we see that when people have brain damage or, in other words, say they have a stroke and all of a sudden reality appears different. It could be that the dolphins are seeing their world differently with this differently constructed brain, and in their very communal, very social, very fluid society. And, you know, they live in three dimensions where we live in two. And Gerritsen said something so fascinating, and that is that their self, they may have a level beyond even empathy where they're more connected. The self doesn't necessarily stop at the perimeter of an individual's dolphin's body. He called it the communal self. And the way I imagined it in my mind was it would be a level beyond empathy. And it explains some of the things that dolphins do that science, you know, hard-edged science doesn't really explain. For instance, when they strand, when they beach themselves, you know, a whole pod might go up onto the beach when only one or two animals are sick. Or in a place like the Cove in Taiji where there, you know, the dolphin slaughter occurs, the nets there, why don't they jump those nets? And this idea of not just I care about you, but I partly am you, this sort of super herd mentality may go towards explaining some of these behaviors that make no sense to us.
They're self-sacrificing.
Well, the self might be different. And there may be a completely different notion of what it actually means to live and die. I mean, these are extremely metaphysical questions that obviously we haven't come close to answering yet. But it's fun to imagine how different a brain, a large, very highly evolved brain that is completely different than ours might perceive a different kind of reality.
Oh, I love thinking about that.
Yeah, it's pretty fascinating.
How do we know, Susan, that dolphins have names for one another? And where do they get those names?
Well, this is a research that has been done fairly recently. And what they have discovered is that each dolphin has a signature whistle that is, you know, tantamount to his name. And they receive those in the same way that we do. They are not born with them and, you know, sort of suddenly start making that noise. They're taught that name by their mother or, in dolphin societies, possibly another mature female. Dolphins and whales have cultures, socially learned and socially transmitted behaviors that are built upon over generations. And this is also fairly new consensus in the science world. And they are, in a lot of ways, if you take a young dolphin, and let's say a dolphin that was born in captivity, for instance, and they don't have the kind of social education that they would get in the wild, that's very closely related to what would happen if you had took a baby human and raised it in a closet. Just this lack of understanding of the world and the others around them. And this is important for dolphins as it is for us.
Do they have different languages from one region to the next, or could different species of dolphins communicate with one another?
Yeah, in fact, that's a really good question. In my book, when we think of dolphins, we tend to think of flipper, you know, we think of bottlenoses. But there are about 37 species of oceanic dolphins and about 4 to 5 species of river dolphins. The number's a little fluid because species sort of it's very hard to pin down the exact number. But so there are a lot of different types of dolphins. There are little tiny Hector's dolphins and all the way up to orcas, which are the largest dolphins, oceanic dolphins.
Well, let me jump in here. We're going to take a quick break. My guest is journalist Susan Casey. Her new book is called Voices in the Ocean, A Journey into the Wild and Haunting World of Dolphins. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372. Send email to think@kera.org or find me on Twitter @ChrisBoydThink.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Fall registration is now open with courses in art, architecture, history, literature, and more. Registration online at smu.edu/CAPE.
call him Flipper, Flipper, faster than lightning. No one you see is smarter than he. And we know Flipper.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with journalist Susan Casey. You just heard the Flipper theme because we are talking about Susan's new book, Voices in the Ocean, A Journey into the Wild and Haunting World of Dolphins. Thank you for indulging me there, Susan. I loved me some Flipper reruns as a child.
Me too. Who didn't?
So could a Flipper talk to a Shamu if they were to meet?
That's an interesting question. Among the orca pods and clans, and they're structured a little bit like states and nations, family states and nations, they do have different dialects. And I think they can probably understand one another, but they also use these dialects to, scientists think, avoid inbreeding. In a lot of ways, the orcas don't necessarily socialize with one another outside of their clans. But among the dolphin community, there's definitely been sightings of mixed pods. Over on Hawaii, where I did a lot of reporting, scientists had seen a pilot whale, also one of the larger species of dolphins, pod with a little spinner dolphin hanging out. And the spinner dolphin was crippled and somehow had been adopted by this pod of pilot whales. And this has been seen elsewhere in the world as well. So I think there is a lot of interaction between different dolphin species in the ocean.
So I've been thinking a lot in recent years, and certainly this book reinforced my thinking, asking questions about like the ethics of whether we should keep dolphins in captivity for our own scientific knowledge, but particularly for research purposes. I want to play some tape here from a guy named Rick O'Berry. And before we do that, just tell us who Rick O'Berry is.
Rick is the former trainer of the original trainer of Flipper. Now, Flipper was played by the male character of Flipper was played by five female dolphins, five female bottlenoses. And Rick had an epiphany one day working with these dolphins, one of whom had just basically died in his arms. And he felt that that dolphin had decided to end its own life by not breathing. Hmm. Dolphins don't breathe involuntarily like we do. They have to decide to take in air. And to him, it was this moment. He had second thoughts about what they were doing with them for the show, keeping them in this captive situation. And he set out after that, he changed his entire life to basically fight for dolphins' well-being all over the world. And I encountered Rick somebody watching the movie The Cove, that wonderful documentary, Oscar winning, and he's the protagonist of that movie, and he was in Taiji protesting the annual slaughter of dolphins there, and also dolphins are taken for captivity there in large numbers, and I really wanted to get to know Rick and his story better.
Here's some of him speaking in The Cove.
When I started training dolphins, there was no manual. I would get the script, and it says, Flipper goes over to the dock and picks up the gun and then swims down left to right. I had to actually translate that into action somehow.
Thanks, Flipper. Yeah, thanks, Flipper.
The thing that really struck me was that they're smarter than we think they are. The house that you see in the Flipper set, where the family lives, was actually my house. I lived there all year round for 7 years. And right in front of the house, there was a lake, saltwater lake, and that's where Flipper was, at the end of the dock. When Flipper came on television on Friday night at 7:30, I would take my television set from the house and go down the end of the dock with a long extension cord, and Kathy would watch herself on television. And she could tell the difference between herself and Susie, who was another Flipper dolphin that was used. I knew then they were self-aware. And when you become conscious of this non-human intelligence, you realize after a while they don't really belong in captivity. But I didn't do anything about it.
That was Rick O'Berry speaking in the documentary The Cove. We're speaking this hour with journalist Susan Casey about her book Voices in the Ocean. So much to unpack there. And I know that you found Rick O'Berry to be just a really fascinating individual. That story about self-awareness is hard to forget.
Well, they've actually, scientists in 2000, two scientists, Lori Marino and Diana Reese, used a standard test to, that is used for lots of different animals to see if the animal is self-aware. It's called the mirror self-recognition test. And how it works is that an animal is given a mark on his body, say something strange, like a big pink stripe on the cheek or something like that. And this had been done with great apes who would then, when faced with a mirror, sort of go up to the mirror, examine themselves, touch the spot, indicate that there was a sense that they knew that that reflection was them. And interestingly enough, this isn't common behavior among many animals. Dogs, for instance, might growl at the mirror. There's only great apes had proven that they were aware that they were looking at themselves until Marino and Reese took two bottlenose dolphins and performed the experiment. And they were the first, these dolphins were the first non-primates to pass the mirror self-recognition test. Since then, elephants have, and interestingly, so have magpies.
So if an animal is self-aware and able to communicate with its mates, that stands to reason that it probably can figure out, whether it wants to or not, it probably can figure out what humans want from it in a situation like, you know, training for performance purposes.
Oh, I mean, they're so smart. One story that I absolutely just, I mean, and I heard a couple like this, but this is a story of a pilot whale and a false killer whale who were both in captivity, I think it was in the 60s or 70s, at a marine park in Hawaii. And pilot whales have a reputation for being somewhat stubborn, a little sulky. You don't often see them in captivity anymore because they don't last very long, as many of these dolphins don't. So the pilot whale, whose name was Bubbles, had a repertoire of behaviors, and one day Bubbles just refused to continue the show. And at that point, the false killer whale, a really agile, very smart, very sociable species of dolphins, just whose name was Swifty, raced in and picked up the show and did every behavior in the exact order that the pilot whale had never been trained to do. It had just been watching.
Wow.
And somehow picked all of this up and finished the show. I mean, it's just amazing.
You said that they don't sometimes live long in captivity. You went to one like dolphin experience place, and I guess the guide there was said, "How long do you think these things live?" And a teenager said, "I don't know, 20, 25 years." He said, "Yes, that's so much longer than in the wild. In fact, the opposite is true."
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it's not like that the oceans are any sort of picnic these days in a lot of ways, but these are animals that are adapted to swim 60, 70, 80 miles a day. Their whole lives revolve around their social lives and their cooperative hunting. I mean, the most important thing in a dolphin's life is other dolphins. And these relationships are as tight-knit as ours are. So the idea of taking a dolphin out of its family and asking it to be in a swimming pool and, you know, you take away all the stimulus, there's no reason for them to use their absolutely magnificent echolocation within a pool. I mean, all the things that they have evolved to do are removed from them. So even if it's the most deluxe captivity situation and they're eating, you know, very fresh fish and all this, that's not a life for a dolphin. That's you could put me in a Four Seasons and give me room service every day, and that's not a life. It just isn't.
There have been people who tried to prove that dolphins and humans could really coexist in a fundamental way. Can you tell us about John Lilly and Margaret Howe?
Well, John Lilly is an absolutely astonishing character. I spent a long time reading and researching and in his archives, and he's just his name looms large when you start to investigate dolphins. He was a neuroscientist who began his career in the 40s, and he was working with the military quite a lot. He was also a physicist and a psychologist. He was a real polymath, very rigorously trained, all the usual qualifications. And his specialty and the thing that really excited him was the sort of the black box of the brain, the magnificent machinery that somehow worked us. And he was working with monkeys and cats and rats in his lab in the 50s and in truly horrifying ways. I mean, vivisection. And he saw a dolphin brain on a beach pilot whale and realized this is the brain that I should be working on. And at the time, he had access to bottlenose dolphins because there was a research lab that had opened adjacent to Marine Studios, a marine park that had originally been built as a movie studio. So it was a more realistic simulation of what the ocean would be like. There were all different kinds of fauna. There was coral. And it was in this giant tank with 200 portholes so that movie cameras could be positioned. But it was so expensive that the public was able to come in. They wanted to sell tickets to offset the cost. And 30,000 people showed up to watch this. It was at a time when nobody had really seen beneath the ocean. Scuba was brand new. And so the people that had created that marine park were also very interested in research. And Lilly got an invitation to come with seven other neuroscientists to Marine Studios and basically have some dolphins to experiment on. And in pretty short order, he killed all five dolphins and realized several things. One, they didn't know anything about dolphins and not even how to keep them alive, and that you couldn't anesthetize a dolphin because it just stops breathing and dies.
Yeah, he didn't mean to kill them. It was accidental.
Not at all, but his intentions were always in the name of science. But, I mean, some of his experiments we would just absolutely cringe at today and the conditions under which everything was going on. But Lilly went on to do a lot to increase awareness in the public that these animals had something pretty special going on, that they weren't fish, that they were these highly evolved, highly intelligent creatures. And he himself was rocked back on his heels by dolphins. And that began a phase in his career where he got a lot of government funding. There was a lot of interest in the mind during the Cold War. There was great interest in the fact that, well, if we had somebody and we poked on this area of their brain, could we get some information? What would happen? Like, how does this all work? And Lilly was making really bold pronouncements about dolphins and basically saying they will teach us how the oceans work and they might know about space and we will be speaking to them and they can tell us all these things. And the collective imagination just was incredibly interested in everything he was saying. But very quickly, Lilly went down the rabbit hole. And there is something about dolphins that makes it sort of easy to go down the rabbit hole. But he got involved in some experiments in he had this lab in the U.S. Virgin Islands, and it was funded by NASA and the Department of Defense and the National Institute of Health. I mean, every tight-lidded, buttoned-down government agency was really interested in dolphins, all for different reasons, and a lot of them having to do with war. But Lilly was there with his dolphins, and he began a run of experiments that got him basically excommunicated from the mainstream science world. One of them was that he took LSD and then gave it to his dolphins and floated in his isolation tank, which is a device, by the way, that he invented for the Army who wanted to study the effects of sensory deprivation. But probably his most notorious experiment was the flooded house with Margaret Howe that you mentioned. And this Margaret Howe was a very game woman, obviously, from the Virgin Islands, a cocktail waitress who was recruited to work at Lilly's lab. And she agreed to live in this partially flooded house for 10 weeks with a young male dolphin named Peter, a young male bottlenose. And the idea being that human babies learn language as they're taught by their mothers and the people around them. What would happen if you took a young dolphin, an animal that obviously has these abilities to communicate, and tried to raise him with a human mother as opposed to a dolphin mother? And so they set out to try this experiment. The house had about 2 feet of salt water in it, so Peter could swim around, but Margaret could slosh around. And her bed was hung from the ceiling, and there was a very rigorous schedule of math lessons and pronunciation and even manners. And the idea being that at the end of it, Peter would be able to speak English, despite his unfortunate lack of vocal cords. But anyway, very shortly, things went sideways in the flooded house. And probably the first indication that it wasn't going to work out that well was that Margaret just could never get dry. And she was bothered by this. She had to brush cut her hair, and you know, her groin was chapped and algae was growing on the walls. But the most the biggest impediment of all was that dolphins are incredibly sensual, sexual creatures. They use physical intimacy to bond in their groups. They're very touchy. Like, whenever you see a pod of dolphins, they're always touching each other and rubbing each other. And Peter, it did imprint on Margaret, but not necessarily as a mother. So I was reading the notes, and they were published, and she took lots of notes, and was basically, there was one line where Margaret wrote and italicized it, "He does not go away." And Peter was following Margaret around the house with an erection and wanting attention in that way, and Margaret was trying to keep him away with a broom handle, but after a while started reasoning to herself, well, if the whole idea behind this experiment is interspecies bonding, then this would certainly increase the bonding. And so she actually began to engage the dolphin in that way. And that when that notes from that experiment were published, that was sort of the end of Lilly's government funding. And I think people look back on it now as just a cruel and unusual experiment that didn't actually yield that much information about dolphins.
It does make for a great story, but yes, it does.
You know, people always want to know about that one.
We'll come back in just a minute with journalist Susan Casey. Her book is Voices in the Ocean, A Journey into the Wild and Haunting World of Dolphins. Up next, we'll talk about some of the threats to dolphins, including maritime sonar and, of course, the hunting and selling of dolphins from the wild. Our number is 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, offering the SMU Certificate Program, where you can take courses in art, architecture, history, literature, and more. Registration online at smu.edu/CAPE.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with Susan Casey about her new book, Voices in the Ocean, A Journey into the Wild and Haunting World of Dolphins. You can join us at 800-933-5372. Susan, of all the different kinds of contamination in the ocean that I hadn't considered, noise pollution tops the list until now.
Yeah, the noise, the issue of noise in the ocean is a very serious one. Not only the sort of quotidian noise, industrial noise, say the millions or thousands at least of tankers rumbling through the ocean. That noise I sort of liken to, it would be like living with a chugging air compressor strapped to your head. For the dolphins and whales, you know, animals that live by their acoustic senses, it very highly sensitive, and it's their main navigational sense as well. It's really problematic, but then it starts to rise from there, and you get into the very high decibel sort of rocket launch level noise, like military combat sonar. And at the very top of the list, at the threshold of the loudest noise that we are physically capable of making, is the oil and gas prospecting technique of towing arrays of air cannons that explode down the water column. And then receive echoes back to seismically chart the seafloor. And those surveys are around the clock, and they're throughout coastal regions. And, I mean, there are more and more of them. And the very loudest noises are proven to kill dolphins and whales. The lower noises just chronically stress them. So they become more susceptible to viruses and illnesses. And, you know, after a while, the immune system just can't hold off any of the pollutants or viruses.
And the ones that kill them outright, that they can have like cerebral hemorrhages because of that sound.
Yeah. So some of the most vulnerable species are the dolphins that live pelagically. They live in the sort of deeper waters of the ocean, and and of course the dolphins don't know that this is going on, and they may be at quite deep depths, and they hear these noises, and it would just be like us if we heard or an explosion or something, we would immediately try to take off. And if they shoot to the surface and they're startled and, they go too fast, they can suffer the same kinds of embolisms and hemorrhages that we would, the equivalent of the bends, even though they're adapted to that depth. And so there's a direct correlation between these Navy training exercises and war games and beachings of whales and dolphins that have blood coming out of their eyes, and they're killed by it.
Let's go to the phones now at 800-933-5372. Tony is on the line in Dallas. Hey, Tony.
Hi there. How are you?
Very well, thanks.
Well, I'm really enjoying the conversation, all the facts, but I really want to talk about some of the solutions I've had in mind. Honestly, I'm pretty appalled after watching The Cove. I know that dolphins have been tested. They are toxic with lead. And first of all, that's just terrible on the part of the economy, of the world, of the pollution is really what I mean. One of the main points I'd like to say is that the Japanese, they have not offered themselves the option to do fish farming. And in the documentary, The Cove, one of the things that the people that were documenting the film offered the Japanese fishermen is, hey, we'll pay you if you'll stop killing these dolphins. And the Japanese rebutted that the reason they were killing them is because the dolphins ate too many fish.
What do you know about that, Susan?
Well, that's true. And they've publicly called the killing of dolphins and whales as something akin to pest control. One Japanese fisheries official called minke whales the cockroaches of the sea. But there's actual scientific research. The ocean isn't that simple. It's a very reductive notion and absurd at that. What creates a lot of fish in the ocean is a fully productive ecosystem with the predators intact and everything else intact. And I certainly agree with the caller that it's this notion of the body burden that dolphins and whales are carrying is really problematic because it shows what's in the food chain. It's mercury, it's pesticides, it's dioxins and PCBs and a lot of these persistent organic pollutants that we outlawed, but they still, they didn't just vanish in a puff of smoke. You know, they're out there, and dolphins with their blubbery bodies tend to bioaccumulate a lot of these very toxic chemicals they bind to fat. So in a lot of places, a dead dolphin would have to be disposed of as industrial waste. And again, that's, a real indication of what's going on in the environment of the ocean that affects us as well as the dolphins. And so it also makes zero sense for anybody to, Japan claims that they eat the dolphin meat, and I suppose they do. I was there and I saw people doing it. It's highly toxic, and this notion of serving it to Japanese school children in their lunches, happily activists and even some Japanese politicians spoke out against that.
If there's enough mercury in their bodies to make us sick eating a serving of it, and I would not eat a serving of dolphin, but just theoretically speaking, isn't this damaging their big brains, all of those contaminants?
Certainly. I mean, mercury poisoning, dolphins are off the charts in mercury poisoning. And it doesn't take very much mercury to cause havoc in the body. And it actually accumulates. It's not like you can somehow get rid of it. So if you ingest even a little bit, the effects can compound over time.
Hmm. Let's go back to the phones now. This time we have Keith on the line in Dallas. Hi, Keith.
Hi. Since dolphins have had large brains approximately 100 times longer than Homo sapiens, I wondered what the thinking is as to why they didn't become the dominant species on the planet. Is it as simple as not being on land or not having an opposed thumb or not having written language, or is it something else?
Thanks for your call.
That's such an interesting question. I think I'll quote John Lilly here. people often say, if the dolphins are so wise, then why aren't they ruling the world? And my very reasoned answer is this. They may be too wise to try to rule the world.
Hmm.
So I guess that my question would be, what's the evolutionary advantage of being the dominant species if the behavior of the dominant species is to undercut its own ability to forge a long-term existence? And I think the jury is out. I mean, I ask myself, are we on a trajectory where we're going to last for 55 million years and we could come out the other end with a exquisitely adapted senses to our environment? I mean, I think we're very young. Our brains are very young, and we could theoretically and imaginatively come up with so many different abilities that we might evolve over that time. But I honestly don't think that the path we're on right now, we have any hope of that kind of longevity. So I'm not too sure what the advantage is. It's kind of an anthropocentric viewpoint to say that somehow we've got it over them because we've managed to dominate somehow. Maybe the idea should be not so much to dominate, but to sort of live harmoniously with what we've been given. And in that regard, they've certainly got it over us.
You looked back through the human historical record and found that people have been writing about dolphins, thinking about dolphins, admiring them, painting them for a very long time. Do you think there's something to the fact that, for whatever reason, dolphins have evolved faces that to us look friendly and pleasant and non-threatening?
Well, I think there's something hardwired in us to sort of to look at faces. That's what we do. Our dominant, how we navigate the world is largely through sight and speech. And it starts with sight, our eyes. And so we look at things and we make judgments on them. And, you know, that may not be the most accurate way to form a picture of anything, but that's what we do. And so the dolphin with its perma smile, it touches something in our heart. But of course, even when dolphins are angry or upset or dead, they have that smile on their face. And in some way, though, I think there's another thing that we're relating to along with the smile, and that's just the vibe that we get from dolphins, that we somehow recognize in them something akin to ourselves. And it's a very ephemeral notion. I spent a long time when I was reporting my book trying to understand that more and examine it more thoroughly. But it's something that's almost impossible to describe in words.
What does it feel like to touch a dolphin?
I've never touched one. I make quite an effort when I'm in the water not to touch things. Mm-hmm. But I certainly made eye contact with many dolphins. And it's a lovely experience because, you know, you're looking at somebody who's looking back at you. And it's, you know, my work focuses on the ocean. And the goal of my writing is to bring people into the ocean in a way that shows them the magic there and the magnificence and this sort of parallel universe that comprises most of our planet. And the idea that there are these sort of these societies and cultures and individuals with names and relationships and struggles over girlfriends and family dynamics down there, it just is so, to me, is just so delightful. That would be the word that comes to mind all the time with dolphins, is delightful and mysterious, too.
Susan, if you see dolphins performing somewhere and you don't think about it very hard, it can be pretty easy to assume that they seem to be enjoying themselves, that they're obeying. I wonder if you can tell us what your perspective is on the industry that uses captive animals to entertain. And a lot of these places say they're also doing education.
Yeah, I mean, I think once you start, you go to a place like Taiji or the Solomon Islands, where I also went, and you see the trade in live captive dolphins, you see the dark side of what looks like a very happy industry. It's quite a dark side. And certainly some places do treat the animals better than others. But as I said before, it's still a very... it's not what biology designed these animals to do, to live in a swimming pool. So what my feeling is about it is that we have about 2,000, let's just take bottlenose dolphins, I can say very quickly that orcas should not be in captivity. They cannot possibly thrive even in the largest enclosures. That said, we have these animals in captivity now, and a lot of them are not able to be released into the ocean. There are about 2,000 bottlenose dolphins worldwide, and it's on us. We're the stewards of these animals, and we have to do the best possible job we can taking care of them. What would be good would be if there really was the intention to educate. A lot of these places pay lip service to that, and I write about that in my book. There's a lot of misinformation. The real biology of wild dolphins, the real science of their lives, is so fascinating. The National Aquarium in Baltimore is actually leading the pack on this. They have stopped their dolphin show. They've stopped the silly tricks. And they are very serious about doing real science and informing the public about dolphins. Because when you start learning all of this, your first question is, well, what are they doing in this swimming pool? The Baltimore Aquarium is now also looking into trying to raise money to build a retirement home for captive dolphins. Chimps have this, elephants have this, but there is no place like this for dolphins. So I follow that effort with great interest, and I think that we need to figure out how best to take care of the animals that we do have in our care, and also to just part of our evolution is to understand theirs. We need to evolve as a species. Why do we feel the need to have these incredibly sentient creatures doing these stupid tricks? And wouldn't it be more educational for our kids to see them in the wild and to understand them in their actual natural habitat? And every place that has a dolphin exhibit or a swim with dolphins area or whatever, I mean, these are incredibly lucrative businesses, has an ethical and moral imperative to try to educate people to take care of the environment, to take care of the ocean. And these, you know, a lot of these places will say that they're doing this and the efforts are pretty paltry.
So until the money dries up, they're going to keep at it.
Yeah. I mean, if you start looking at the percentages of the funding of going to research and conservation and the educational efforts they're not up to snuff at all.
The new book by journalist Susan Casey is called Voices in the Ocean, A Journey into the Wild and Haunting World of Dolphins. Susan, it's been a great conversation. Thank you so much for making this time for us.
You're welcome. My pleasure.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is associate producer with help on the phones today from Braylon Becton. Our executive producer is Jeff Whittington. I'm on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think. You can contact the show via email at think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.